This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Point uncertain whether he would ever walk again. I'm very pleased to say that he has managed to walk here. Please welcome, ladies and gentlemen, in conversation with Paul Blessard, Charlie Borman.
Hello.
I'll sit there. You sit
there. Oh, I see. That's okay. Good. But I wanted to sit there.
Well, no, you can't. It's my seat.
But I always, it's like Anton Deck. I always sit on the right.
Which one are you?
I'm the good-looking one.
Yeah, obviously. Right, quick show of hands, just so we know if we're in the right place. How many of you have seen Long Way Round? Excellent, we're in the right place. How many of you have seen Long Way Down? You're in the right place. Good
that
start.
That would be very awkward if no one put their hand up, wouldn't it? It'd be like, oh, okay.
See, the thing is, people that have seen those shows think they know a bit about you, but can we just spend the first 5 minutes or so? I just want to do a little voyage around Charlie so we know who you are. I'm fortunate enough to call you a friend, so I know bits about this. But you're so renowned for being on screen on two wheels, but when did your relationship with two wheels start? Do you remember your first bike memory, push bike memory, scooter memory, whatever?
No, I do. I mean, very much so. I don't know if anyone knows, but my father is a film director, and he directed films like Deliverance and Excalibur and Hope and Glory and Emerald Forest and all sorts of movies. And I'm one of four children. I've got three sisters. And so whenever my father was making a movie, he would always say, no, we won't employ any children. I've got four free children, so we'll use them, because he's quite tight. I'm sure, I think he was half Scottish. Sure. Anyway, so we were always, you know, we grew up in and around film sets, and the first film I was ever in was a Deliverance.
Yeah,
and I wasn't the banjo player, just so
sure.
You know, so my dad said, "Look, Charlie, if you sit on that sofa with that bloke, I'll give you a tricycle." And it sounds quite dodgy, but I really wanted that tricycle. But so that's kind of how it started, and I was very shy at that time, and I remember sitting on the sofa and John Voight was playing my father and I was supposed to sort of look in certain directions, but I wouldn't lift my eyes up. And my father said, "Look," so he got one of the cameramen to hold up the scooter, and then if I had to look over here, the cameraman would walk on that side of the camera and he would move the camera left and right, and I would just be staring at this scooter. So I think maybe that's where the kind of love of scooters and motorbikes came from. And then I think very much, so all the movies that my father did were all very, very adventurous movies.
Yeah.
And, you know, in South America, South Carolina on the river and in the South Pacific with Lee Marvin and Toshiro Mifune.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So there were lots of sort of... So that's, I think, where I got my kind of adventure from, was from him.
Do you remember your first motorbike, your first powered vehicle?
Yeah, my first motorbike was, my father did a film with Sean Connery called Zardos.
Oh, yes.
Which was kind of an odd film. I don't know if anyone remembers that, but and his son Jason Connery, who he played Robin Hood, you know, Robin Hood on did anyone remember Jason Connery? And anyway, I beat him in MasterChef, just so you know. That was very important. But and when he was living in our house, because Sean Connery lived in our house when Dad was making the movie.
Right.
And so every Friday, Sean would come with the money and he would count out his board and lodgings to my mother.
Bless.
And give her the money. I mean, my mother met, you know, my father, and we grew up in the film industry and met lots and lots of famous people. But Sean Connery was the only one that my mother absolutely just, you know, she would just go doughy-eyed every time he walked in the room.
But she still take the money off him.
She still took the money, yeah. So Jason, someone had left a little Honda monkey bike in the barn, and Jason had found it, and we spent about 3 hours pushing that thing to get it started, and eventually we got it started, and Jason had a go, and eventually he let me have a go after quite a long time. And I remember I was so proud. I was on this motorbike, and I was riding along, and I came up onto this sort of lawn that Dad was outside the house, that Dad and Sean were standing there talking. And I went past him, and as I went past him, he just grabbed me by the hair and pulled me off the bike. And I remember looking up at him incredulously saying, what have you done to me? And then just as I looked at the bike, that just smashed into a barbed wire fence.
Ooh.
And so that was... I should have learned then, actually.
Yes.
Because that was just a series of just falling off motorbikes and breaking bones.
We might come to disaster shortly. It is, in fact, the nature of the book we're here to talk about.
Yeah.
So let's skip through a few bits, because you've done all sorts of things. You did painting and decorating, but largely you went into acting. You were dyslexic at school. So yeah. how did the experience of growing up with your dad and being on film sets translate to actually formally acting?
I think, I always struggled in school. I am very heavily dyslexic. And,
right.
and I found it really difficult to read, very difficult to spell. And so that kind of limited my options of a further education. So I left school at 16. I really wanted to be an actor. I was already starting to work in movies. And so that's what I did. And I think my father encouraged it because he saw that I was struggling in school, but I quite enjoyed being on stage and entertaining and stuff. So he kind of nurtured that. And so I had a relatively good career, I suppose, in the 80s. And then I started choosing movies for their location rather than the script. So someone said, oh, there's a movie in Africa. So I'd go off to Africa and I'd read the script on the plane and it was terrible. And I would go, well, at least the location's great. And so my acting career sort of went spiked like this and then kind of went down very, very fast. And then, of course, as every actor has experienced, you know, an actor's favourite other job is painting and decorating.
Right.
And so I kind of got into that and then I started doing people's houses up for about 10 years.
Okay.
And my acting career was just sort of slipping away from me, really. And I'd had with my wife, and I'd got two young children, and you know, I was really struggling. But in that 10 years, I did the odd movie in that 10 years, and that's where I met Ewan. Was somewhere in that 10 years, about 25 years ago, I met Ewan on a movie set.
Do you remember what the movie was?
Yeah, it was a film called The Serpent's Kiss. Of course, you all remember that film, don't you? It was my big comeback movie.
Okay.
And because it had a Pete Postlethwaite, Greta Scacchi, Richard E. Grant, Ewan McGregor, and
brilliant
me.
Cast.
I mean, it was brilliant. I should have known that we were having such a good time that, you know, that was doomed. But so the film came out and basically nothing happened to it. I think it went straight to DVD and then straight from DVD went straight to the bin.
But you'd met Ewan.
But met Ewan.
Become firm friends, shared love of bikes.
Yeah.
And I assume somewhere around there the conversation out of which sprung Long Way Round came about. Is that how it worked? Or
yeah, I mean, more or less. I mean, we became friends, and we. I think our first conversation was about motorcycles, and then we did everything with motorcycles together. We ran motorbike race teams. We went and did track days where we take our motorbikes on the racetracks and went around racetracks. We did small little trips together. There was about five or six of us who used to all just hang around and ride motorbikes together, And eventually, we just started thinking about maybe doing another trip, or a longer trip. And we thought we'd go down to the south of Spain first and meet our families down there, and ride down there, have a holiday with the families, and then ride back again. And then I remember one time, I remember Ewan said, "Oh, look, Charlie, I think you know, I've got this idea. I think you should come round," because we were already sort of talking about maybe going to China on the motorbikes. And he came around and he had this big map of the world sitting there, a bit smaller than this one. And he said, "Look, I've got this idea." He said, "Forget China. You know, if you look at China, it's just here, but just up here is the Bering Straits."
Yeah.
"And so we could just go into Russia and just hop over to Alaska and then finish off in New York. What do you think?" And I thought, brilliant idea. And so that's sort of how it looks. You know, if you're ever trying to convince someone to go with you on a long trip, you know, don't get a big map out. Go to Stamford's and get a small one and just say, "Look, we're going from here to here. It's not very far.
It's only a foot and a half."
It's only a foot and a half. So, you know. And then once they've said yes, then get a bigger one from Stamford's and then start your planning. And it sort of went from there. And it was an idea that just never went away, really. And we kept coming back to it. It wasn't something that kind of happened overnight. And then at one stage we kind of realized that it was going to take at least four and a half months.
Right.
And you know, I had two young children and a mortgage and, you know, usual trappings. And Ewan had just done Star Wars and he was minted. And I was thinking, well, because he's Scottish, nothing's coming from there. So we were trying to... I hope no one's Scottish. I'm just joking.
Hands up if you're Scottish.
I have lots of friends who are Scottish, and they're all stingy. But so we were trying to sort of figure out a way of doing it. And then a friend of Ewan said, oh, you know... Maybe a book would be a good idea.
The book came first,
and so they said, you know, it'd be a lovely idea of two friends on motorbikes going around the world. You know, who knows what would happen, and we'd sort of go from there. So the book thing was, the deal came okay. So we sort of had the money to do it, but then Ewan and I, you know, walked out the door having done the book deal and thought, that's brilliant. Fantastic, we got a book deal. And then I turned to you and I said, you do know I'm dyslexic and I have no idea how to write a two-page story. And you and Christ, he said, I can't really write or read either. And so we kind of panicked and thought, oh my God, what are we going to do? We got this book deal. So we thought, well, what we'll do is we'll keep video diaries. We got this friend of ours who was a brilliant guy to help us sort of construct the book and help us write it. So that was, and then we thought, well, if we're going to film it, why don't we film it a bit more and we could just do a little bit of a video to go beside it. And then we thought we'd get a TV deal, and we thought, you know, got Ewan McGregor, Star Wars, Obi-Wan Kenobi, and the TV show would come really easily, but it didn't. It was a real hard sell.
Oh, really?
And people said, you know, because you would go to these pitches of these TV people, and you would say, look, yeah, we're going to be on these bikes, we're going to travel around the world, and we're going to go to all these different countries, but we just have no idea what's going to happen. And the TV says, is going, oh, so that's interesting. So it was quite hard, but we eventually got a deal, and it's just funny, it just kind of snowballed into what happened. And I truly, honestly, Ewan and I had no idea what we were doing. And we kind of bumbled off with Claudio, our cameraman, you know, the three of us. And you know, Claudio was a complete nutcase. He lied about having his driving a bike license. He said, have you got a bike license? He said, yes. And then when we got closer to leaving, because of insurance and stuff, you have to have a license. And eventually I have to have a license. So I rang up to, you know, I said, Claudio, will you bring your license in? Because we need it for insurance. And you know, he's Swiss Deutsch, and he goes, Charlie, yeah, no, I am interesting about that, about the bike license. And I said, oh yeah. He goes, yes, well, it was on here, but it's not anymore. I said, was it ever there? No. And then he took his bike test, failed it three times. Eventually got his bike test, and so, you know, he could carry on the bikes. But, you know, I've done 5 TV shows with him where he's been riding motorbikes, and I honestly, he's the only person I know who hasn't gotten better at riding a motorbike. I mean, that guy fell all the time. I mean, it was extraordinary. I remember one time we were in the middle of nowhere in Russia somewhere, and early on-ish in the trip, and we had these walkie-talkies so we could talk to each other. And so Ewan and I are ahead, and in the middle of nowhere, right, not a single person around, and the radio comes on, hello? And it's Claudio. Yes, we know that, Claudio. And he says, yes, I think I've fallen off. I said, so Kim, I said, well, you either you have or you haven't, Claudio. And a long pause, and he goes, yes, definitely. So we came back, and there was this motorbike splattered all over the thing, and he was walking up the hill, and he goes, yes, you'll fix that. And then we had to put the bike back together.
But
so
that was Claudio.
And that's kind of how it started. And you know, we had no idea that it would be, you know, that I'd be sitting here with you guys chatting away, you know.
If you were to start, knowing what you know now, if you were to start that again, what would you do differently? Just briefly. And then we'll cut to some VT.
Nothing.
Nothing. You go in the same sense of innocence, naivety, and adventure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's part of it. That's part of the adventure. You know, the adventure is about, you know, I suppose the thing I've learned about it is that you know, if you do go off on an adventure or a trip, you know, it's definitely about going from A to B and sure, all that kind of stuff and getting to your destination. But really, it's about what happens along the way and about the people that you meet and the situations that you get into and the fear of breaking down or something going wrong with your motorbike or your car or whatever it is, thinking, oh my God, you know, what's going to happen? But that actually turns out to be sometimes the best parts and the joy. It may not be nice at the time, yeah, but you would meet someone, you'd go on to something. And
one or two of my experiences, would now be a good time to show the VT of nut munching?
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, we're talking about sort of food, really, is what we're talking about. And food is a big thing when you travel.
When you're engaging the cultures through which you're traveling.
Yeah, and as well as that, you know, food to sustain yourself, to, you know, if you have lack of food, everything becomes much more difficult and it's harder. And when we went through Mongolia, we really completely underestimated that, you know, we thought there was going to be a Kentucky Fried Chicken and a McDonald's in every corner. And there really wasn't any food around. And most people are very self-sufficient in Mongolia. And so we really struggled with food. So we ended up going to people's gurs, so these semi-nomadic tents where you would sit, and people, you know, were self-sufficient. They'd have their goats and camels and cows and horses and sheep and everything all around them. And if you stopped, we'd set up camp near them, and they would invite us in and feed us. So we were sort of begged our way across Mongolia. And this one time we go into this gurr and we said we'd like some food. And so we sat down, they gave us a cup of tea, which is very nice. And then they said, would you like some food? And we said, oh, yes, please. And they lifted up this cauldron, and in this cauldron there were 200 testicles bubbling away.
We have it on VT.
And we had to eat these testicles. And so we convinced them to give us one each.
Yes.
And so Ewan ate his. He was very good. He's not a gagger. And I ate mine, and mine was quite large. His was very small. I don't know why that is. But he ate his fine. I thought, I'll just put it in my mouth and swallow it and just pretend it was nice, you know. But it was too big, so I had to bite into it, and it burst. And it was just what that whole representation of eating that thing. But anyway,
would you like to see the experience of?
I'm so sure.
Can we have the VT of him? I think it's called. You know which one it is.
We're camping tonight with the support team, and some locals have invited us into their gur for tea.
Would you like to eat nuts? Nuts.
Oh, my Lord.
It was balls, cow balls, sheep balls, and goat balls, and there were 200.
Go on, have a bull's nut.
No.
Have a look at it anyway.
I don't want to have a bull's nut. I don't want to eat nuts.
I guess we should try, but it does worry me slightly what it's going to be like to eat.
Slightly.
Okay, one each.
Okay, we'll go for it.
Just one each, though.
One small one each.
And they all thought that was quite funny, just having one, because they want to have big bowls of it, big bowls of balls. Ewan went first.
I've only got a wee one.
He's very good about eating that kind of stuff. He can do it.
Go, baby.
All right. Oh, yeah.
It's very good.
Yeah. Oh, sorry, just thinking about it.
Not to me. Did you eat it?
Go on, Charlie.
No.
Did you eat it?
Did it go down?
Yeah.
I'll get off.
Honestly, I didn't do it. I can't do it.
I'm only the
woman in the world.
Here you go. He's eating one here.
Go on, Ross.
Here.
Go on, Russ. Go on, Russ. Play through the hair there. Oh.
Sorry, I couldn't do that.
You did just go on again.
Nearly. I'm sorry.
Oh, dear. The things you do for entertainment.
I know, but my producer Russ always says, Charlie, you know what's good for the show is bad for you, and what's bad for you is good for the show. So it's just, it's a complete nightmare the whole time. So, and it's extraordinary. I mean, I never thought that I would sort of travel the world and eat the most extraordinary things, from turtle testicles to snake's blood to, oh my God, to just, it's extraordinary to.
Can we talk a little bit about this book?
Yes,
because we're rapidly running out of time.
Yes, of course.
2 years, February the 16th, 2016.
Yeah.
You're in Portugal. What happened next?
Well, I was. I do a lot of work for a Triumph, which is a motorcycle manufacturer.
You're a brand ambassador for Triumph.
Brand ambassador, yeah. And it's a British company, privately owned. Bikes built in this country. It's a fabulous story.
Chaired by Lord Digby Jones.
Yes, yes, and it's a wonderful. Well, anyway, so I'm known for adventure riding. So I'm ambassador for their adventure bikes, and so this 2 years ago this month I was in Portugal launching their new 1200 adventure bike, instead of launching the bike, I managed to launch myself. So we had the world's press there. And we're going out very early in the morning, and I was slightly delayed. I had to pick some tools up before leaving, so I was just slowly catching up with all the journalists. And as I passed this car, the car just decided to turn left. Oof. Down this little road, and the car clipped me, and then I launched off the bike and hit a wall, and I managed to break my right ankle very badly and dislocate it. And I smashed my left tibia and fibula, and all the bones came out of the skin, and it was quite a mess, and the only thing holding my left leg on was my calf, so they had to sort of put all that back, and then I was suddenly left with this huge kind of sort of rehabilitation. I think to date I've had 10 operations, and still I can't walk very well, so I'm kind of only back to sort of 80% of what I was.
Well, this is called, the book's called The Long Way Back. It's the story of how you approached rehabilitation from this awful act. I mean, you did your hand, you did your wrist, you broke.
Yes, yeah, I did. I remember lying there, and you know, if you come off a bicycle, or come fall off a horse, or come off a motorbike or whatever, you know, your first instinct is to jump back up. And get on the bike and pretend that you haven't fallen. So when the next person comes along, you just sort of wave and go, "No, I'm all right. I'm just, you know." And so I remember coming off the bike, and I remember heading towards this wall. Yeah. And I was flying through the air, and there was this big curb that was coming towards as well as this wall. And I remember sort of heading towards the curb and thinking, "Oh my God, this is gonna hurt." And you know, when you have these big, huge crashes, people say that your sort of life flashes in front of you. But all I thought was, oh, lots of really bad words. This is going to really hurt, you know. Mm. And oh my God, did it hurt. I hit that wall so hard. And you know, when they talk about you've been hit by something and it rattles your teeth. Well, that's how it felt. And I was lying there, and I got up to go and walk again, and this leg was flopping around. And, it was sort of blood was spurting out everywhere. I remember sort of standing up and thinking, oh, I better sit down again. So I sort of sat down, and then I thought I didn't want to look at it, so I kind of lay back down again.
Did you lose consciousness or anything?
No, I was awake for the whole time, sadly. Okay. And then people turned up, and then the ambulance people turned up, and they were dealing with this, and then I kept saying to them that my right ankle was hurting a little bit.
Right.
But I wanted to play it down because I was thinking I didn't want anything more to be wrong.
Yeah.
And so they cut my right boot off, and that was my ankle was very badly dislocated and smashed to pieces as well. And they were all speaking Portuguese, and Portuguese you could tell because you know when they cut the trouser leg off my left leg, and they would all be talking, and then there was you know, this would come up, and then you think, oh, that's bad.
You do want to hear doctors say that.
Doctors,
do you?
Yeah, who've seen it all, you know.
Exactly.
And they go, ooh, that's not good. And then when they cut off my boot, it was another, ooh. That was like, oh my God. And then I remember sort of looking at my hand, and there was this massive dent in my hand here. And I was going, excuse me, is that normal? And they were going, ooh. No, it's not normal. I was And eventually I was sort of, and the worst thing was is that at some stage they have to straighten your leg. Because and put it in a splint because otherwise it can be dangerous with bone rubbing on bone, and I think quite fortunately they were all speaking Portuguese because I remember them putting this sort of stick up the side of my leg, and then they were sort of shouting something at me, and then this big yank to sort of pull my leg straight. Anyway, so off to the hospital I went, and my poor wife was at home. And Billy, who you know, who I do the motorcycle tours with, he was back in London, but they were corresponding through him to my wife. And Billy said, you know, oh, I don't know if you know, but, you know, Charlie's had a little accident. I don't know if he's called you yet. And Ollie said, no, he hasn't. He said, well, we think he might have broken his leg. And, you know, when did you last speak to him? She said, oh, about 20 minutes ago. So it all happened so quickly.
Lord.
And then he had to ring up again and go, well, I think it's probably quite a bad break on the left leg. And maybe you might have to think about coming down. And then 10 minutes later, it was like, oh, well, I think he's broken his right ankle. And then it just went from bad to worse. And I remember just lying on the road and just thinking, you know,
you knew
what
it was
am
bad.
I going to do?
You
yeah,
knew.
What am I going to do next? And I went in and I had emergency surgery to fix my legs and get them to a point where I could be repatriated. And I was flown home in a private plane.
Air ambulance.
And it's a real... I know you're all here, and I don't know if any of you... How many of you are planning a holiday at the moment to come here and heading off somewhere? Well, pass by your travel insurance company and make sure you're absolutely togged up. Because my flight home cost £20,000. To fly me home.
You were insured. You got proper insurance.
Yeah. And I've had 10 operations, and I was luckily insured for all of that.
Good heavens.
But it can really, really mount up. So.
Of course.
But so I go through all of this experience. I'm sitting in my bed, and my agent, Robert Kirby, my literary agent, I quite like to say that, he said, look, Charlie, I think you're going to be bored out of your mind if you don't... if you don't keep you busy. So that's how the book came about. So it was supposed to be about my memoirs, because I talk a lot about growing up with dyslexia in school and struggling in school and all this kind of stuff. And so when I was starting it, I spoke to my dad. I said, you know what, I think I'm going to write this book. And he said, oh, you should start the book and use the book as your rehabilitation, but tell your story as you go along. Yes. Of your life. And he said, like a typical film director, he said, what you should do is you should start the book. You're lying on the ground, on the middle of the road, thinking, oh, F, what F just happened, you know? And that's how you should start the book. And that's how I started
exactly.
The book. And, you know, my dad's 84 years old, and his mind is as sharp as a button. And I tell you, if it wasn't for his memory... I would never have been able to write this book.
Oh, really?
I don't know if it was I drank too much as a child, but I you know, half the stuff I can't remember. And what's really interesting about stories about growing up and stuff and with your sisters and family involved is that you remember it one way,
yeah.
Your father remembers it another way, and then your sister remembers it a third way. So you've got to sort of
match
talk
them all up.
To at least get three people's opinion of a particular
Cried.
Story. So
there's
so
a really lovely thing about this book, that for everybody here that's seen Long Way Down, Long Way Round, with this book we get a real sense of the man behind the adventures and everything that you bring to it, from all the experiences in Ireland, from all the adventures yeah. as a kid with your dad. It's a beautifully done book. Congratulations on it.
No, thank you. Yeah.
Give us the update now. We'll let people discover the whole story through reading this. How are you now? What's the prognosis? Because you're limping, and I hear you yelp from time to time.
Yeah, no, it's still very painful. My right ankle's in a real mess. So I've got what you call... it's like if you get a major trauma in your ankle or high impact in one of your joints, what happens is your joint gets compressors and it pushes everything out of the joint, so all your cartilage and whatever it is, so that's all gone now.
Right.
And so now it's sort of bone on bone, so it just crunches along when I walk.
Yeah.
And so that's painful. So I think I need to get that fused, where they'll screw a couple of rods in and so that the ankle doesn't move anymore, and hopefully that will stop the pain. But other than that, it's sort of okay.
Are you back on a bike? Are you able to ride?
I mean, I've been back on a bike for a long time. It was 5 months after I had the accident. I had this big cage around my leg, holding with all the wires going through. Have you seen those external fixations? And pretty ugly looking thing. I went to a Halloween party and I hadn't dressed. I was just wearing a pair of shorts, and the person looked at me and said, well, you haven't made an effort. And I said, look at that puppy. And he looked at it and he went, oh, my God, that's disgusting.
That's so realistic.
But so after about 5 months, I couldn't ride a motorbike because the cage, I couldn't change gear.
Sure.
Because I couldn't get my foot close enough to the bike. So I was riding my wife's scooter. So I was going around on the scooter with two crutches because I couldn't really walk on my ankle either. So I'd go off up to... I'm involved in a restaurant called The Bike Shed up in Shoreditch, which is a kind of a motorcycle kind of restaurant, club. It's a really cool place. If anybody wants to go up there, it's really cool. But I would go up there on the moped, but I didn't have the strength to put my moped on the centre stand. So I would wait by the motorbike and ask someone walking past if they could put the bike on the centre stand for me. And they're sort of looking at me, and then I would sort of hobble off on the crutches going off. But I do remember one time, so on my 50th birthday, still had this cage and stuff. 2 days after my 50th birthday, I get on my wife's scooter, and I'm pushed the scooter back, and the wheel's on full lock, and I've got this blanket that goes over my legs, and a bit of it had gotten caught in the steering wheel. So when I went to accelerate off, the steering wheel didn't go back, and I just went bang and just hit the deck outside my house, hit my hip on the left-hand side, and the bike landed on my cage, and the blood was pouring out everywhere, and I thought, oh my God, after 6 months or 5 months or 6 months of rehabilitation, I've rebroken my leg. I mean, it was horrendous. My hip, I thought I'd broken my hip and all this. So the ambulance people come and they said, what happened? I said, well, I was sitting on this stool fixing my bike and I just fell off. Right? And the guy looked at me and he goes, Charlie, I know who you are. And he said, I don't believe a word you said. And I go, no, that's the truth. Anyway, so they get me in the ambulance and I go to the accident and emergency. And it's like a Saturday afternoon, really busy. And I'm sitting there, and they hand you over, right? And they say, OK, Mel Caucasian, suspected broken hip, 50. And I just thought, oh, my God, wow. I'm old.
You're old.
And, you know, I can almost smell the retirement home coming on to me. And I was so depressed. But luckily, for some miraculous reason, I didn't break my leg again. But anyway,
cool.
So, and then off to do a couple of motorcycle tours.
Well, tell us about one of which. First of all, tell us about the business that you run, because you do tours for those who are interested around Australia, parts of Africa. Yeah. Tell us about the business.
Yeah, I take three times a year, I take people on motorbikes through Africa. So I go from Cape Town to Victoria Falls, and we go South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, Zimbabwe. And then we get another bunch of people and go Zimbabwe, Botswana, South Africa, Lesotho.
Right.
So we do a big tour of Southern Africa.
And what are these called? How can people find them?
They can find them on my website, charlieborman.com or stuff. And then I do one in Australia as well, from Sydney to Melbourne.
Wow.
Melbourne to Sydney, sorry, via Tasmania.
Superb.
So lots going on. And then a TV show coming up this year. And so always trying to push the boundaries, you know.
Good. We've got one last piece of VT. Would you like to see Charlie doing something else equally silly? Tell us what this is about and why you've got a whip in your hand.
Well, I suppose it's always on these TV shows that you do. One of the great things about them is that you get to learn, you know, different skills. And so I was in Canada doing Extreme Frontiers, this TV,
oh, yeah,
TV series that I did. And I went to Calgary and I met this girl, Kateri, she's fourth in the world at extreme horse riding.
Right.
Which is, they do the most crazy thing on horse riding, like these giant seesaws that you have to get the horse to go up in these seesaws and crash down the other side and balancing down steep. I mean, incredible talent this girl has. Anyway, so I'm waiting in her ranch just on the foothills of the Rocky Mountains, and she comes galloping across this paddock on this horse, galloping. She screeches to a halt, and the horse skids to a halt. And he puts his head down, and she slides off his neck and lands on her feet. She goes, "Hi, I'm Kateri." And I was like, "Hi, I'm Charlie." And anyway, so she said, "I'm here to teach you to be a cowboy," and I think I did rather well, actually.
Shall we find out?
Yeah, I think we should.
Can we roll the whip, VT, please?
You're using the whip. This is the handle,
mm-hmm.
And then there's the neck here.
Yep.
And then this part is the heaviest part of the whip, and this has to stay in motion. And then what it does is it actually breaks the sound barrier. So when it flicks, I can already tell this is going to be funny. Straight up and straight down.
Ow!
Jesus!
Simple.
Oh, that really hurt. Duck, he's done it again.
Oh,
no, back again.
Did this happen to you when you started? Oh, God! Oh, I just f***ed us! Oh! Oh! God, that was a double whammy, that was. Really hurt, that one. Oh!
Come up to 12 o'clock.
That was really hot. That's it. Ow! Oh, God, what am I doing? That's it. Forget it. Oh. Okay, should we go for a horse ride?
Sure.
did you ever get the hang of it?
No, but I did ride the horse a little bit better. I did. There was someone, she did just look at me so disappointed that I sort of failed in every... On every part of my cowboy bit. And actually, a couple of days later, I went to a rodeo, and they said, do you want to ride a bull? And I said, well, okay. And
so ride a bull.
Ride a bull. It was this baby bull, this sort of half sized bull, and a young male. And so I sat on this thing, and the gate opens, and I come flying at him all over the place, and about halfway across this arena. I fall off and head plant into the thing, and I get up and I can hear the crowd roaring, and I think, God, I must have done really well. And then I realise they're roaring with laughter. And then I look round at the cameraman and he can barely hold his camera. And I go, what the fuck are you laughing at? I said, I rode a bull. And he goes, look at this. So I played it back. And basically, I come out of the thing, and I'm sitting in the camera, and my feet are practically touching the ground, and all this cow is doing is just trotting. And all I'm doing is trotting, and I've just slid off the thing. That was it. And in my mind, I was this hero.
You were the hero.
My ride, and oh my God.
That's true of all of us so many tremendous times. We have 10 minutes or thereabouts, 8 minutes for questions from you to Charlie about anything you want to ask him involving bikes, horses, whips, whatever. Who'd like to kick us off with our first question? Who's going to be brave?
Oh, no.
Lady there. Thank you very much, madam.
Hi. I'm not a bike person, motorbike person. I've been on them once in Vietnam. But I do a lot of cycling. I've cycled around lots and lots of countries around the world. Have you ever thought about doing a cycling sort of long way down or anything like that?
A cycling? I think it's you know... When we did Long Way Down, and when we were in Sudan, we came across this guy who had been cycling around the world for 14 years. He had been cycling around the world, and he was just on his way home. And we said, what are you up to? And he goes, okay, his first question was, you know, when did you last pass water? And all he had was these water bottles hanging off his thing, you know, being in the Sudan desert. And of course, on motorbikes, couldn't remember. We said, yeah, it was just back there somewhere. And he goes, well, how far? You know, anyway, and I said, where are you off to? He said, well, I'm off home. My mum's not very well, and I'm heading home. It's going to take me another couple of months to get back. And so we met him, extraordinary guy. And then 24 hours later, we camped out along the Nile. And then as we left, we met this Japanese guy who'd been on the road for 7 years. And then 4 hours later, we met another couple who had been on the road for 6 years.
Good Lord.
I mean, all within the space of sort of 24 hours. So huge, and you see people all the time. Did you have any experience of going through Ethiopia? And the Ethiopians do love to sort of throw stones at you.
No, but when I cycled Vietnam, I had a woman hitting me with a stick.
Oh, nice.
Because I was wearing shorts.
Serve you right.
I know. I've been shot at cycling coast to coast in the States. They tend to like you to use their target practice.
I remember I did the Dakar Rally once, and I broke my hands on that one, actually.
Oh, you did?
And I remember a couple of years back, I was talking to a competitor, and there were these guys up in the sand dunes with rifles, and they were gambling against each other as to who could hit one of the vehicles going along. So that kind of has. But this guy was telling us a story when he was up in Mongolia, and he said the most depressing thing was it's full of mountains, Mongolia, especially the highlands of Mongolia. Of Ethiopia, apologies. And he was going through Ethiopia, and he said that the hills were so steep that he'd be cycling up this hill, and these kids with rocks would be walking beside him, getting ready to lob the stone at him. He said that was depressive.
In the Afar Mountains, yeah. Yeah, cycling the long way down,
but
that would be tough.
I can barely walk now, so I think as long as I had an engine, I'm quite happy.
There are lots of people that cycle Cairo to Cape Town. It's quite a well-known cycle route. If you're feeling brave, good one to do. Another question.
Durable.
Anybody else like to ask a question for Charlie? Gentleman there. Yes, please. Thank you, sir.
This is going back a bit before your days with motorcycles.
Okay.
And going back to the place just above where the gentleman there is, what would you consider to be your most terrifying experience with insects?
Insects. I remember I was up in Russia, over there in the Far East Russia, near a place called Magadan, which is really nowhere, really. And the Magadan, and then the next place is the Bering Straits, and there's just nothing up there. And I remember needing to go to the bathroom, and the mosquitoes were so big there that they looked like Lancaster bombers as they're flying towards you, and you could actually swat them away. They were so big and so slow, you know. And I remember going to the bathroom, and I remember, you know, I needing to do, you know, the number twos, and I was underneath this bridge doing my business, and then by the time I did that and pulled my trouser, I had been bitten, I don't know how many times in this area.
Yep.
And that was pretty horrific. And then cooking, I remember we were cooking, and I had a scarf that was held to here like this. I could just see this much. And as we were cooking boiling water, these mosquitoes were just falling into the water.
Oh, good Lord.
As we were cooking into our stew. It was extraordinary how many. It was like a plague. It was extraordinary.
Yeah.
What about ants?
Ants? No, not so much ants. I did a movie once in Brazil once, and I was working. I was doing experience with the indigenous tribe there. And one of the guys cut himself when I was with him, and he got these leaf cutter ants with the big pinchers.
Yes.
And he got his cut, and he got the leaf cutter ant pinchers, and he put it on either side of the cut, and it pinched his skin, and he twisted the head off.
Used them as sutures.
And left the heads in his arm.
Yeah, I've seen that done. Another question. Is everybody still awake? Have we drilled you to sleep?
I've bored them. We've senseless.
Charlie Borman.
All right.
I'm sorry.
Brilliant. Well, there you go.
If there are no more questions at all, one last question from me. What can we expect from you coming up in the future? Are you got any good projects you're allowed to tell us about?
Yeah, I've got a couple of projects. There's a TV show which looks like will go ahead, this year, and it's kind of sort of adventure and cooking and you know, one of my biggest inspirational people was Keith Floyd,
and I
love Keith Floyd, who travelled around the world cooking in the most extraordinary places, and I've always loved cooking. I did MasterChef a little while ago, and
did you enjoy that?
I did. I loved it. It was hard work, but it was quite stressful. But I came joint second.
Who won?
Sophie Thompson, Emma Thompson's sister.
That's right. Yeah.
And I remember being in second place with them. I remember we were cooking in the final, and I was with Jodie Kidd. Did everyone know Jodie Kidd here?
Yeah.
Fabulous, fun girl, and we were cooking away, and Sophie was on this station over here, and Jodie was behind me, and I was cooking this masterpiece. This is what I thought it was, and I looked over at Sophie Thompson, and she was cooking the most extraordinary, fantastic, and I thought, oh my God, that bad words. Has just done it. And I remember going over to Jodie. I said, Jodie, I said, we're absolutely finished here, because I said, have you seen what that woman is cooking? And so we both steamed over there, with sort of looking at her like this, going, what are you doing?
And how?
And she goes, what? I don't know what. So we both lost to her. No, but she was a deserved winner. It was great fun, but hard work. So combining all those kind of things and music and people I love all that interaction. So I'm sort of trying to sort of put that into one show.
Culture, cuisine, and motorcycles.
Yeah.
A winning combo.
Yeah. Or I could just become a rock star and do it another way.
You still could. Do you still act?
No, not so much anymore. I struggled acting. I really did. I've been so heavily dyslexic. I, yeah. I, I, I really struggled to retain my lines, and I used to get terrible ulcers, and I used to get incredibly stressed out doing it and stuff. So when I eventually sort of found doing Long Way and stuff like that, what I love about all of those is coming up with the ideas and then finding the money and then working on the production and getting the TV show done and then working on it afterwards. And I'm involved in the whole thing. It's Ewan and I own the production company. And so it's a whole sort of thing. And it allows me to be creative and to still do television and still perform. And so it's all good stuff.
The question I thought somebody might ask from the audience is one I know you've been asked a lot. Is there any chance of you and Ewan reuniting for another trip?
Doing another one? Yeah, no, I mean, actually, Ewan was... he was just over here a couple of months ago doing making a... Gone out. Oh, there we go. He was just making... I thought they were saying, can you get off? You're just boring everybody. All right, just a wave would be good, you know. Anyway, he was staying with me for a month or so, and we started talking about it. So,
okay.
So I think almost definitely there'll be another one.
There's always potential. If you need any...
As two grumpy old men this time.
Two grumpy old men on motorbikes.
Yeah, travel around and go, well, back in my day it was much nicer.
Exactly. Saddle's not as comfortable as it used to be.
Yeah. What are they making these days? They never make it how they used to.
Exactly. yes, well, hopefully Triumph will... Are you still Triumph brand ambassador despite Portugal?
Yeah, despite the crash. I'm actually off on Saturday to launch... I'm going to Morocco to launch the upgrade of the bike that I smashed 2 years ago.
Be careful how you use the word launch.
I got an email from the guys at Triumph saying, look, Charlie, you're looking forward to having you over in Morocco, but let's not try to get another book out of this one.
I'd hate to see your insurance policy. In case you need further inducement to join Charlie over at the Stanford's book signing tent for this extraordinary work, it's really, really beautifully told. He says, that's how I began to think of my recovery. A rally, a journey, an expedition marked on a map. I'd ridden the long way round and the long way down, and now I was attempting to make the long way back. It also has a very poignant foreword by his great pal, Ewan McGregor. Would you please give huge thanks to Charlie Borman? And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Cheers.
Bless you, Charlie.
Thank you, Paul.
Come on.
Well done, mate.
See you,
thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.